Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith and the City, the Ethics Center Symposium for 2007. It's great to have you all here. This has been a day much waited for and planned for, so it's terrific to see you here. We're looking forward to a great morning together, and to officially begin things with a welcome and some words, I'd like you to greet Colonel Glenn Shepherd, who is my boss, who is the chair of the Ethics Center board and is the chief secretary or the second in command for the Salvation Army in the Canada and Bermuda Territory. So, Colonel Glenn Shepherd.
Thanks very much, Jim. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to this symposium this morning. The symposium is an event that occurs on a biennial basis as part of the Ethics Center mandate to help us as a Christian community think about ethics and to think about justice. Thinking about ethics and justice is an important part of who we are. At its very origin, the Salvation Army was a movement that was not only passionate about spiritual revival, but was passionate about justice. And we made a series of choices in our early days, choices about taking positions concerning penal reform, the abuse of girls, unhealthy working conditions. It's been part of our history. And one of the good news stories in the evolution of the Salvation Army in the 21st century is that we are recapturing that strain of who we are. And I'm delighted this morning that Jim introduced his boss. I can introduce my boss, Commissioner Christine McMillan, who in about 2 weeks will be moving to New York City to take up a new responsibility as the Salvation Army's International Commissioner for Social Justice, helping us as a movement think about justice and right behavior. The whole purpose of today is to help us think biblically, so that if we think biblically, we will more intuitively act in a biblical way. Strong decisions are rooted in the Bible. I could take you to a little village in the Massif Central in the center of France, a little village called Le Chambon-sur-Lignon. In the summer, its population is about 10,000. In the winter, about 1,500 people live there. But during the Second World War, the Reformed Church there was the center of a strategic plan to help move children, Jewish children, out of France to safety in Switzerland so they would avoid certain death in the concentration camps. And the story is told, the story of the pastor, André Trocmé, who was the real driving force behind this, is recaptured in a book entitled Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, which you can get from Amazon or you can find in most libraries in French, the original version of Le Sang des Innocents. And it tells of all the structure and all the activity that this church did under the nose, so to speak, of its Nazi occupiers. The day came when Trocmé was arrested by the Gestapo and taken away. And as they led him down the street to prison in Germany, his parishioners marched behind him, singing, "A toi la gloire, thine is the glory, risen conquering son." Sometimes we feel that we're just a few parts per million, and it doesn't really matter what we think or what we do, because nothing seems to change. But we are the advance guard of a heavenly drama, a cosmic drama to reestablish creation the way it was in the first place. You remember in the story, be it historical or mythological, of the Garden of Eden, that creation was perfect and relationships were perfect. Listen to what it will be like at the end. In Revelation, "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away.'" And in Revelation 22, there's the image of the river, the water of life, flowing from the throne to the middle of the streets of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit in each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. One of the reasons we are here, the Salvation Army, one of the reasons the church is here, one of the reasons that God is present even now through his people as we await the coming of the New Jerusalem, is that we sketch out a project for justice where there's no more crying or mourning or pain. Sometimes that role can be a bit combative, but at the same time, the presence of God, the leaves of the tree, are for the healing of the nation. I can't think of any better reason to be alive than to be a beacon for justice and an agent of healing. And I'm looking forward this morning to being challenged in my own soul as we interact together around the issues that affect life in the city. So may we be open to hear what God has to say to us through our guest, Jonathan, and through each other as we interact.
Our keynote speaker and one to stimulate our thinking is Dr. Jonathan Chaplin, who comes to us also as the Deborah Jane Gowland Memorial Speaker. We are grateful to the family of Deborah Jane Gowland and Diane Phippen for their support of this kind of ethics education. Makes these sorts of events much more feasible, and we're grateful to them for the kind of support we're able to have through that foundation. Jonathan Chaplin, you're going to get to know his mind better in this remainder of this morning, and he's going to come and speak to us for the next hour. But as he comes, note that he has been, for just about the last year now, the director of the Kirby Lang Institute for Christian Ethics that's at Tyndall House in Cambridge, England. I got to know Jonathan when he was in his previous capacity as member of the faculty and then in administration as academic dean at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto that's associated with University of Toronto, Toronto School of Theology. Jonathan took a first degree in politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford University, completed an MPhil at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto, and a PhD at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Dr. Chaplin's research interests are in Christian political theory and political theology, especially Christian conceptions of the nature and role of the state. He has edited or co-edited three books in Christian political thought and published a range of articles, copies of which we have, I think, in a binder in the table at the back there, but published a range of articles on topics including the nature of the state, liberalism, law and religion, civil society, pluralism, democracy, and contemporary political theology. His monograph on the political thought of Herman Dooyeweerd is due to be published at the University of Notre Dame Press, and he's currently editing a book on the role of religious faiths in American foreign policy and working on a book presenting a Christian perspective on the state. So we're really very pleased that Jonathan has agreed to be our key speaker for this event, and we'd welcome him to the lectern now.
Thanks very much, Jim, for the introduction, and I'd like to thank Colonel Glenn Shepherd for introducing the morning with those moving words. I had the feeling listening to him that I'd rather just sit there and let him carry on for the next hour. In fact, already by yesterday, I think I'd met about half a dozen people who I thought were more qualified to give this speech than me, and now this morning there's about another 25 of you out here who I think fill that bill. But you've got me, you flew me over, and you're stuck with me for the next hour. So it is a real privilege to be here. Although I don't have a lot of time to take in many of the other events surrounding this symposium, nonetheless, it's an honor to be invited to give this speech and to meet many of you for the first time and meet a couple of people who I haven't seen for several years, people I met when I was living in that relatively minor city in southern Ontario. Some people think Toronto is smug and self-satisfied, and they're right. They're right. I can say that now because I don't live there anymore. You should have in front of you an outline of the structure of what I'm going to say. I probably won't be able to get through all of this in the time allotted. The third section, section C, city government, street level justice, may get squeezed, but I've already anticipated that, and I've included some comments under that theme already in sections A and B, so you won't be missing out a whole lot if I don't get through to section C. If you have a particular interest in that, one of the articles that I wrote in the journal Comment, I think, is probably available in that binder at the back. Although I'm not by any means an expert in urban affairs, I have lived and worked in several cities, including Toronto, of course, London, and now in Cambridge, really just a large town or a medium-sized town. And I was born in Manchester, as you probably surmised already. Actually, I was born probably about 2 miles from Manchester United Stadium, but then my family made the unwise decision to move out of the city and live in Cheshire, so I had to travel in for games, but that was still worth it. Born in Manchester, which might be called the mother, if not the mother of all cities, the mother of many of our modern cities, the key motor of the Industrial Revolution, which spawned the modern cities that we've come to know today. But my main expertise, as Jim explained, is really in Christian social thought. However, since cities are really a microcosm of society as a whole, I think we can usefully apply some key principles of Christian social thought to the specific question of what makes for healthy cities. And let me just mention here that one of the sources I've drawn on in thinking this through is the work of the Hamilton-based Work Research Foundation, which I'm affiliated with. And I think some of their publications are also in that binder at the back. They have a very interesting journal called Comment. It's an online journal. You can easily Google it. And in the last couple of years, they've had extensive reflections on urban affairs, faith in the city, faith and the role of the church in the city. So I'd certainly commend that journal to you as one source among many of the others that are there at the back. Here's what I'm going to try to do in about 55 minutes. I want to begin in the first section by offering a brief sketch, selective sketch, of the makeup of our modern cities. And I've called that section Pathologies of the Late Modern City. Then in the next section, I want to outline 5 core principles from Christian social thought that I think can help frame and stimulate discussions about faith in the city. And I'll add some comments in passing there on the role of faith communities in cities. Although I already said this somewhere else, it seems a little preposterous for me as an academic theorist to come here to talk to the Salvation Army about the role of faith in city life, given the Salvation Army's outstanding track record of faithful, committed service to the most vulnerable people in our modern cities. I have not been part of the Salvation Army, but of course it's come up in conversation in my life many times, and I can say I have never once heard anybody say a single negative word about the Salvation Army anywhere. So congratulations to you for your role in making that. That's the first bit of flattery. I've got another one later on. Some of you may be thinking, he doesn't know the Salvation Army very well. So that's the second section. And then, if there's time, I will say something about city government. Yesterday, in a lecture I gave, I spelled out what I take to be the core task of government in general from a biblical perspective, the task of the promotion of justice in the public interactions of society. If I get to that section, I'll explore how this might apply at the level of municipal governments. So I should confess then, having told you what I'm doing, that the title of the talk doesn't quite reflect what I'm going to do, but I hope it at least stimulates some excellent discussion. I'm sure it will, and I'm really looking forward to being part of that discussion and learning a lot more about what this means on the ground from a bottom-up perspective from many of you who are seasoned, experienced practitioners. So let me start then with the first section, Pathologies of the Late Modern City. And I think I concluded after preparing this section that the tone was probably a bit more bleak than it should be. I love cities. I've always loved living in cities, although I now live near the countryside. But the focus here is on the dilemmas and the pathologies and the problems that we face in the cities that we now inhabit. Cities obviously existed long before the modern era. There were city-states in the ancient world, like Athens. There were important medieval and early modern cities like Florence, Paris, Prague, Geneva, Cambridge. I have to throw that one in as well. But these were obviously pre-industrial cities. They mainly consisted of residential areas. the largest proportion of the city territories were people living in houses. Their economic activities were integrated into the life of cities without dominating them, generally speaking. Many of them contained inviting open public spaces, traffic-free, of course, accessible walkways, markets centered around churches, cathedrals, town halls, or other civic buildings. And they were, of course, much, much smaller than any of the cities we know today. Here's an odd fact I picked up when arriving in Cambridge. King's College Chapel, which is the most imposing building in Cambridge, actually just covers a few acres of ground. Apparently, when it was built, I forgot exactly which century. If I said the 13th or the 15th, would it matter? I'm not quite sure. Anyway, a long time ago, when it was built by an autocratic king, it required the demolition of 25% of all the residential houses in Cambridge. I mean, that's just a way of saying it was a tiny town. In fact, it still is. You can still walk across the city centre of Cambridge in less than half an hour. But cities typical of the modern era, the modern city, are vastly different. And they're characterized by many distinguishing features. Let me just list a few of the more obvious, all very familiar to you, I'm sure. The first is the enormous scale of modern industrial cities. They're miles across, sprawling metropolitan areas, especially, of course, in the developing world. Secondly, demographic density, the sheer concentration of population in a single center. Apparently, Winnipeg has a population of about 700,000, Jim was mentioning yesterday, but that's now quite small in relation to many global cities. Mexico City, I can't remember how many millions. Is it 15 or is it 30 million or more? 28 million, thank you, 28 million. I mean, that's many, many times larger than many nation states. Third characteristic, what I've called functional complexity. That is the huge number of specialist functions and tasks that take place within cities, reflecting primarily the advanced division of labor in highly technological economies. The fourth characteristic, interactive intensity. There are far more encounters per day with far more people in modern cities than there ever were in pre-modern cities. And the frenetic pace of life increases that. And yet, finally, impersonality. Some of you last night, I think, saw the movie Crash. How many of you saw that movie, actually, or have seen the movie Crash? It's strong stuff. I saw it a couple of years ago. And to me, it's a very powerful evocation of how, on the one hand, humans still long to connect with their fellow human beings across social barriers. But city life often locks us into ourselves and our own narrow groups and keeps us apart, leaving us without any sense of belonging, without any sense of social responsibility, vulnerable and fearful. Well, how did we get there? Well, the story of the emergence of the modern city is pretty well known, and I'm not going to rehearse any of the details. I'll just give you a very quick overview just to refresh what I'm sure that you already are familiar with. Technological, political, and economic developments in the 18th and early 19th century made necessary a new and intense concentration of economic activities in the rapidly expanding urban centres. Cities like Manchester, one of the first in the 19th century, to begin to suck in masses of people relentlessly from the countryside and put them to work in factories using advanced and highly productive industrial technology, generating enormous increases in output and profitability. This major development in the 19th century changed the demography and the economy of Western societies forever. But for many, as you know, it was a profoundly disruptive and damaging process. People were severed from close kinship and neighborly ties that were typical of stable rural communities or small towns, and thrown into heaving, restless, and constantly expanding urban spaces with crowded, inadequate, and unhealthy housing, working long hours, often in very unsafe factories, and struggling desperately to keep their families together under immense pressure. The new industrial cities seem to throw everything into flux. As Karl Marx put it, industrial capitalism meant that all that is solid melts into air. And he was right about that. A key point I want to make here, without rehearsing all that story again, is this. The early development of many of our modern industrial cities was profoundly unbalanced right from the start. Driven by narrow economic imperatives, little attention was given to what might be called a social ecology that would replace the organic ties left behind in rural communities. Now, in time, of course, genuine communities did develop, even in these seemingly inauspicious circumstances. Sometimes very strong urban and durable communities emerged in or around the major cities, often around a dominant industry or trade route. And what's more, as the 19th century moved into the 20th century, the worst excesses of industrial capitalism were tamed, and to some extent, humanized. A degree of economic justice was restored to the workplace and to the economy generally. Education, health, and welfare services gradually came to be provided, and the glaring inequalities of the 19th century were gradually mitigated, at least. And for all these things, which took place largely in cities, we should be grateful. Modern cities also produced many great achievements. So earlier I said that my story sounds rather bleak, but I do want to note the immense achievements that have been made possible by modern cities, which is why so many of us love them so much and love to be in cities. They provided employment, prosperity for many, often for the first time. They generated incredible intellectual and artistic creativity, architectural splendors of all kinds. They produced cultural diversity, the intermingling of people from many different societies and cultures. I could go on praising cities, but I think you probably can fill in the blanks there yourselves. Nevertheless, I still want to say that the legacy of a distorted industrialization is still with us in many of our modern cities. Cities were principally designed to meet the needs of economic growth and individual freedom, not balanced human flourishing. Okay, that's the first part of the story of the emergence of modern cities. Since then, of course, throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st, many other changes have taken place. Many of you know that story much better than I do. Let me just flag up a few highlights, major transitions that cities have been through. There was the phenomenon of, at least in the UK, post-war urban planning, a huge new development of municipal expertise deployed, often well-intentioned, aimed at redressing many of the social problems that had been generated by industrialization. But at that time period, in the middle of the 20th century, so much of it was governed by norms of efficiency rather than human flourishing. Social scientific methodologies applied to design cities according to careful specifications, but often it seems overlooking the human beings that actually had to live in the buildings and by the roads that were being designed. So, for example, in many industrial cities, there was a large-scale demolition programs of what used to be called slums, many of those in Manchester, of course. And in their place, and nobody really regretted the demolition of those inadequate examples of housing, but in their place, the erection of impersonal high-rise apartment blocks or large uniform housing estates, which made community very difficult to realize and often kept people apart, even though they were living right next door to each other. And crucially, of course, this post-war planning was principally designed around the automobile as the principal means of transport, rather than human scale and social needs. Now, of course, since then, there's been a retreat from that rather bureaucratic kind of urban planning in that period. Some of you will know a lot more than I do about a movement called the New Urbanism. That's just one instance of a reaction against this kind of bureaucratic, monolithic kind of city planning, emphasizing instead diversity of uses of land and space, architectural diversity, and many other things. So there's a healthy reaction to that, which of course many of us, I'm sure, will support. So that's one of the developments. Then suburbanization, the flight from inner cities, often for understandable reasons, parents wanting to take their children away from seemingly dangerous, impoverished areas to safe, pleasant, more accessible areas with space. But the consequence was, for many cities, the depopulation of downtown areas. Interestingly, this didn't happen so much in Toronto, which is why it's, I think, a really great city to live in. And I had a wonderful 8 years living there in the downtown area. Having said that, I lived, if you know Toronto, I lived in an area, Bloor and Lansdowne, which was notorious for its street life reputation. So these two things are juxtaposed in our cities, aren't they? You have these terrible concentrations of degradation and poverty. And yet, 200 meters away where we lived, a lovely family street with trees and people and neighbors. Strange ambiguity of the modern city. But suburbanization, a major development. With people fleeing inner cities, often it was those who were unable to move who were left behind. The poor and the resourceless, the vulnerable, those who couldn't afford to buy properties in the expanding suburbs. The consequence being donut-shaped cities, visited by commuters, but not lived in them by them. A third development, changing the face of our modern cities and turning them into what we can really call late modern cities, post-industrialization, the process of post-industrialization. That is, the shift to an economy based not on mass production in traditional heavy industries like mining, steel, and so on, manufacturing, towards a knowledge economy, a knowledge-based economy, where services are often more important than manufacturing. Now, again, post-industrialization is not in itself a bad thing. The post-industrial economy is cleaner, for a start. In many ways, it's more accessible to many people. It generates many new kinds of interesting employment. But at the same time, it's often less secure. And that's related to the next major development, which is part of this same process, namely globalization. The process whereby the whole world becomes a single market economy, leaving national governments with far less political control over economic developments. And where the economic consequences of global free markets cannot be challenged and mitigated anything like so easily, certainly not by national governments, and therefore far less by city governments. So many cities, therefore, are left exposed in the kind of winds of global competition, unable to defend themselves against these forces which nobody seems to be able to control. Another factor, massive population movements in the last 20 years, perhaps especially 25 years. Migration, immigration, forced population movements, refugees moving in millions across the world, and many of them ending up in our modern cities, rootless, severed from their homelands, from their families, poor, unable to communicate in the language of the host country, often homeless and vulnerable. In fact, it's probably true to say that the cities of the 21st century are as full of lost strangers today as the early industrial cities of the 19th century were. And finally, ongoing environmental damage. Most environmental pollution, it's obvious to say that, comes from cities. In spite of very encouraging environmental policies, often introduced by municipal governments, recycling schemes, and so on, nevertheless, cities are still the chief polluters of our time, and we have to live in them. So that is a very broad and selective overview of where we are today in terms of our city life, of some of the pathologies of our late modern cities. Awful lot more that could be said about that, and I'm sure that many of you would be able to flesh out many of the details there in terms of what it looks like on the ground. But let me move on now, secondly, to my second section, which I've called Towards People-Shaped Cities, Some Insights from Christian Social Thought. And I do this really to stimulate suggestions in the discussion times from many of you for the kinds of changes that we'll want to seek in our cities. To give a sort of framework, a series of pegs to hang our thoughts around as we move into discussion. And so I've selected five key insights or five key principles or goals. Solidarity, liberty, diversity, ecology, and locality. Again, it's far from comprehensive, but it may be useful just to stimulate some discussion. Now, you'll note that these terms themselves are not theological terms. They're not terms that come directly out of the Bible. But I do think, and I'll try to explain this, that each of them reflects key biblical concerns on which there's been really a wide measure of consensus across many different traditions of Christian social thought. So let me start with solidarity. Christian social thought has always taught that human beings are inherently social, inherently communal. In Genesis 2:18, God declares, "It's not good that the man should be alone." Now, the immediate context there is the male-female complementarity of the human race. But I think it's fair to interpret that as a paradigm for human relationships generally. We are created for community. And though our communal instincts are broken and distorted by sin and selfishness, they are being restored in Jesus Christ. The New Testament term to capture this really is the term koinonia, fellowship, which is to characterize the people of God, and through them to be a witness to a renewed creation with all the implications that that will bear for our contemporary societies. Now, I've picked the more modern term solidarity. This term has been sidelined in recent political debate, at least in Britain, I think pretty much the same here as well. And it's taken a back seat to individuality. Solidarity, it seems to me, has been seen as belonging to a past era of trade unions. You know, you always think of trade unions when you think of solidarity. And well, we've had enough of those, haven't we? At least that was the message being pumped out pretty forcefully in the 1980s and 90s in the UK, and it's to some extent here as well. It's a term that's been linked then and therefore discredited for many by its association with trade unionism, with the movement of socialism. Well, I think we need to revive it and fill it with new meaning. Paul describes believers in the body of Christ as members one of another. And as I said earlier, this, I think, points to a norm for wider society, because the church is nothing other than the signpost of a renewed creation. It's not as if there are two ethical standards in the world under God, one for the church and one for the world. There's no two-tier ethic in Scripture. What is called for in the body of Christ is a pointer to and an illumination of what God requires for human flourishing, for the whole of creation. All of us, whether we share the same faith or not in Jesus Christ, all human beings are members one of another. So, can we begin to envisage cities again as places where there can be new expressions of human solidarity, a new rediscovery of the meaning of fellowship, even in our urban concrete jungles? Well, just to go back in history quickly, I missed a part of the story. As the Industrial Revolution progressed, this natural inclination to community and solidarity could not be suppressed. And it led to the creation of many new forms of association, many new expressions of solidarity to fill the gap left by industrialization. Trade unions would be one great example. Welfare organizations, health insurance schemes, charitable bodies, businesses, of course, and many of them indeed with a social conscience, political parties, and the list goes on endlessly. Indeed, the 19th century was the great era of voluntary associations. There was a huge flowering of these new expressions of solidarity in our industrialized cities. And the image I think of here is that these were like flowers forcing themselves through the cracks in concrete sidewalks. The spirit of community and solidarity could not be suppressed. It's something that's programmed in us by our Creator. And it will out. The question is, how and when and in what ways? And can it be elicited? And can it be encouraged? And that's the challenge that we face today. And in that challenge, as you know, Christian faith played an absolutely crucial role in many countries of Europe and North America and elsewhere. And I'm just going to strain your patience by reading a quotation from an article about Toronto again. Sorry, I won't go on about Toronto the whole time. This is from a publication of the Work Research Foundation by a friend of mine, Russ Kuykendall. The subtitle of his article is, "What Would the City Be Like If Faith Had Never Lived There?" And what he does, he conducts a sort of guided tour of one of the main streets in Toronto, College Street, where I used to work, actually. I wish I'd read the article when I was living there, because I missed a lot of what he's saying in this article. So he, as it were, takes us on a guided tour of just a few blocks of College Street, asking the question, what would it have looked like if there had been no faith, if there had been no churches? Well, I'll skip out his initial guided tour, and I'll just move on to the core passage. So what would the city be like if religious, specifically Christian influence, had never lived in Toronto? There would likely be no Eaton's department store. Well, some of you might think that would be a good thing, but I'll pass on that. Since Timothy Eaton's enterprise and business drive was informed and impelled by his Methodism, there would be no YMCA, since this was a cooperative effort of 19th century Toronto Protestants of various stripes. There might well be no Dundas Street, as we know it, or Bay Street Financial District, since the former was paved by James Beattie, a Christian entrepreneur, and Bay Street was built by Ulster Protestants. I didn't know that. Presbyterians, Methodists, and Disciples of Christ. There would be no Women's College Hospital, founded as it was because Ontario's first female licensed physician, Jessie Kidd Trout, became a physician motivated by her Disciples of Christ faith and impelled by a Christian ethos to found Women's College. Likewise, Sick Kids Hospital and Toronto General Hospitals were organized, funded, and built by Christians acting together and informed by their faith. There's more. The same is true of Mount Sinai, founded by Toronto's Jewish community, informed and moved by their faith. The Canadian Red Cross started, again, as a cooperative Protestant effort spearheaded by Dr. George Sterling Ryerson. The University of Toronto was founded as a federation of church colleges. Won't list them all. The neo-Romanesque architecture of the legislature and the Gothic Revival design of the colleges and hospitals reflected the faith of their organizers, founders, funders, and builders. And the Cecil Street Church of Christ building provided a spiritual home to Toronto's growing turn-of-the-century Jewish community when it was converted into a synagogue. The final sentence sounds to me a bit speculative, but I'll read it anyway. Even College Street's streetcars might well not ever have run its length as they still do, had it not been for Christian entrepreneurs and investors, impelled by their faith, who first created a streetcar system. Well, you get the picture. That's just one city in one country. Undoubtedly, a similar story could be told in almost any modern Western city, a large number for sure. Perhaps it can be told here in Winnipeg as well. I wouldn't know that. Certainly can be told in Cambridge, in London, and indeed in Manchester. So let me stop there with solidarity and move on now to the second main theme. Just keeping an eye on the clock here. Oh, wait, no, I can't do that. There's one more piece of flattery. I was going to read this to you. Sorry, yes. This is the Salvation Army's contribution to the story. Again, this is from a journal published by the Work Research Foundation. This is a report called Living on the Streets, The Role of the Church in Urban Renewal. It's a very short, readable report, and it's based on research done in Hamilton. So at least it's not Toronto. There's some light relief. And it specifically singles out the Salvation Army. So sit back and just flatter yourselves for a minute as I read this. Of the many organizations that find their roots in faith communities, the Salvation Army is perhaps the best suited to offer social service to the community, product of its unique history surrounding their founders, William and Catherine Booth, and their mission to the slums of 19th century London, England. Major Jacobs, is the person being quoted, notes that the Salvation Army is the number one provider of transitional and emergency shelter in Canada. You knew that, of course. in the Hamilton area. These include the previously mentioned Booth Center, Grace Haven, a home for teen mothers, and Lawson Lodge, a care center for the physically and mentally disabled. Salvation Army thrift stores are also well known across Canada for selling donated clothing. I don't have any Salvation Army clothing on right now, but there was one around the corner of Laura and Lansdowne in Toronto, and we frequented it quite often. It was always a choice between that and Value Village, and usually Salvation Army was better quality. Sorry, that's the last bit of flattery, I'll say. Any profit realized is funneled back into other service programs. Major Jacobs added that in Hamilton, the Salvation Army staffs and operate a suicide prevention and crisis center 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The Salvation Army also sends out a soup van 365 days a year that serves as many as 300 people in a single day. The list goes on, the article says. Now, you knew that, but I just wanted you to hear that the Salvation Army is one of many, many faith organizations that has been at the forefront of introducing expressions of concrete Christian solidarity in urban centers that were suffering from all the pathologies that I've mentioned. So now let me move on secondly to the theme of liberty. Now, liberty is often seen as the opposite of solidarity, but it's never seen so in the Bible or in the traditions of Christian social thought. Christian faith does value liberty very highly. Most fundamentally, faith itself must be the free response of the individual to God and to the neighbor. To exercise responsibility under God, we must have space to make responsible choices, to develop plans, to set up projects, to take initiatives, to go wherever our talents and our callings and our Lord leads us. And that kind of spiritual freedom is the basis, I would suggest, for the affirmation of many other personal freedoms that we have come to enjoy in our Western societies today and in many other societies as well. Freedom of movement, freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience. It's true that one attraction of our modern cities is indeed the liberty, the freedom that it offers, allowing people to break free from the experience of conformity and compulsion in more traditional communities. That's why many people still flock to cities today. But Christian social thought has always seen freedom as for a purpose. It's never self-justifying. Freedom, biblically speaking, is space for the service of God and neighbor. But sadly, so much of the supposed freedom of our modern cities is unfortunately the freedom for the pursuit of self-interest. And ultimately, it turns out to be empty and unsatisfying, leaving people in their own private bubbles of indulgence, separated from their neighbors, even when they're living right next door. And the domination of cities by the automobile, something I mentioned earlier, reflects the priority of individual convenience rather than the demands of social or ecological integrity. And let me just throw in here one aside, one sort of concrete public policy aside. It seems to me here that there's only one response to this kind of domination of cities by the automobile, and that is a radical shift in the direction of integrated public transit systems. I don't see any other alternative to that. Now, that's all of a sudden concrete policy proposal in the middle of a fairly high-flying abstract discourse. But I just wanted to throw that in to bring it down to earth. That's what it means. If we are to balance freedom and solidarity in modern cities, it will mean public transit systems that reduce our dependence on the car and get us away from designing cities around the needs of road building. This same pursuit of a self-interested freedom that is so much part of the modern experience of cities, at the same time, is fine for those with the resources to exploit that freedom, but often that freedom is at the expense of those with few resources, who end up actually with constraints on their liberty, trapped in rundown neighborhoods with little prospect of improvement or escape. Hence, I've subtitled one of the points I put there under point two is the ambiguous freedom of the city. Moving on, diversity, third key theme or goal. Now, this word is overused today. I think everybody would probably agree with that. But again, I think like solidarity, it's a word we need to reclaim and fill with new meaning. To assert diversity is not to affirm just any kind of difference or any claim to rights by any minority group that constitutes itself for that purpose. Rather, we need to ask the question, what kinds of diversity reflect God's good purposes for human flourishing? What kinds of diversity contribute to that goal? And let me just mention two or three here. I've already cited one, actually. The diversity of associations expressing solidarity and service that have emerged in our modern cities. These are the basis of what now is typically called the realm of civil society, the area of independent associational activity apart from government and apart from the market. Educational, welfare, health, cultural, leisure groups, housing associations, food co-ops, childcare providers, women's groups, etc., etc., etc. The list goes on, and I would guess that if we did a quick sample poll of everybody in this room and totted up the number of individual associations like this represented here, we'd probably end up with, well, more than the number of people in the room, because some of you will be attached to two, three, four, many, many more. I would guess that we'd be in excess of 100 or 200 associations that would be represented just in this room. And I think a key theme here, and this has been central to much of Christian social thought, is that we have to oppose the political control of these free associations. What you might call the municipalization of everything. For example, here, I'm coming down again to public policy with a bit of a bump. I think we need to oppose the assumption that if organizations like these are in receipt of public funds, then governments can control their internal activities, as if it's some kind of a deal. You take money from the public purse, and thereby governments can get their hands all over you and control what you do. That is a widespread assumption in our modern societies. It's certainly very widespread in Britain, and there are many conflicts raging over that right now, and I know from my years in Canada that it's an issue here too. It's an assumption that we have to challenge. The fact that government gives public support, public financial support, to civil society associations like these does not entitle it to control them. These associations do not become part of government. They do not become extensions of government. The task of government is supportive, not controlling. But nevertheless, there are many close partnerships between the free associations of civil society and municipal governments without domination. That's a perfectly healthy kind of relationship, and many of you will know the details of how that works on the ground. Let me just mention one example I came across in some literature. In the city of Indianapolis, the city government created something called the Front Porch Alliance. Some of you may have heard of that. I hadn't before. This is a city agency designed specifically to support free associations and civil society and link them together. It's been called a civic switchboard. But rather than controlling those services or absorbing them or taking them over, it simply encourages networking among them and helps clear the paths in negotiating with municipal laws and so on and so forth. To me, it's a model of the servant role of municipal governments in relation to these free associations of civil society. And perhaps there are parallels in other cities as well. I'm sure there will be. But voluntary associations don't always need governments to get them together. Spontaneous networks can and should and do emerge. I mean, of course, most cities have councils of churches or interfaith networks. These weren't created by municipal governments, thank goodness. As soon as municipal governments get their hands on councils of churches, you know, the show's over. But that's only an example in the area of faith communities. There are many other of these spontaneous networks bringing together people working in housing or in transport or in anti-poverty work, whatever it might be. So we should not always, in the first instance, look to government to take the initiative in this coordinating task that takes place in civil society. So that's just one kind of diversity. I wanted to flag it up. Associational diversity that makes for a healthy city. A second kind of diversity I just briefly want to mention is cultural. I don't need to say much about this in Canada because we are all familiar with what multiculturalism means, and we experience it in most of our larger cities, certainly. Toronto, of course, being a major example of that. Most late modern cities are increasingly multicultural. And I think that we, as believers, as I'm sure we all do, should see this as an opportunity for enriching ourselves through cross-cultural encounter. Hearing stories of how God's good works, through people of faith or not, have come to expression in many, many different cultural contexts. Of course, we shouldn't be naive about the challenges of making cultural diversity work and affirming cultural diversity. We shouldn't be naive about the differences that emerge between different cultures, and there are indeed limits to the capacity of modern cities to accommodate degrees and scale of multiculturalism. Don't want to get into that debate right now, but it's obviously a debate that needs to take place. But the starting point, I'm sure you'd all agree, from a Christian standpoint, is affirmative. We believe in a gospel in which there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, and we can demonstrate that. And churches do demonstrate it in many city areas by crossing these national, racial, and ethnic boundaries. Churches then can be a signpost of true multiculturalism by embodying that cross-cultural diversity in their own congregations as far as that's possible. And then they're well placed to serve as intercultural bridge builders in cities generally. And there are, I'm sure you could tell, I've heard of many stories like this, where churches themselves embodied cultural diversity, inspired by the gospel, and then served as a beacon to the surrounding neighborhood or the city to stimulate cross-cultural interaction and understanding. Okay, let me move on. I've still got a bit of time left, haven't I? There's nobody telling me not, so I'm going to carry on regardless. Fourth point, ecology. Ecology. I said something about this, and I'll just add a few brief comments here. I think it's true to say that Christian social thought has come late to this principle. Now, if you look back prior to the 19th century, really prior to the 20th century, there was very little serious Christian reflection on the human task of stewarding the natural environment, at least not that I've come across. But we're catching up. And indeed, in some cases, we're now in the forefront of movements to honor the natural environment that God has made us stewards of. Let me just mention here, too, the sharp difference, which still exists, I think, between a modernist view of nature and a biblical view. In the modernist view, of which industrialization is the classic example, nature is a mere resource to be exploited by humans for their own material benefit. The relationship between humans and nature was seen as oppositional. Nature as a mere instrument, a mere tool of human aggrandizement. But in the biblical view, there is a relationship of partnership. There's a covenantal relationship between God and the entirety of his creation, and by implication between human beings and the natural creation. Indeed, God has appointed us as stewards of the creation to till and to keep it, to honor its integrity, to value it for its own sake and not merely as a plaything, to recognize the interconnectedness of the natural environment, to work for sustainability. As I mentioned already, cities are the chief polluters of our modern times. And I'm referring here not only to the physical pollution of things like, you know, urban spaces, air, waterways, and so on, but also things like noise pollution that everybody suffers as soon as you step outside in a modern city. Well, of course, there are signs of hope here. I already mentioned that there's a recycling movement in many cities, and You know, we all struggle in our own faith communities to try to get our organizations on board here. Having said that, I'm the first of sinners this morning by having drunk a cup of coffee out of a plastic cup, which is going to be tossed aside somewhere. So we're all struggling to get there. But this is obviously the right way to go. But beyond that, I said also we need to push for public transit systems to replace dependence on the automobile. We need to work in cities for the expansion of green spaces wherever we can. But more broadly, and I think this is the bigger point I want to make, ask the question, why is there such environmental damage in the modern world? It doesn't just happen. It's the consequence of our economic, of our passionate addiction to endless economic growth. The relentless consumerist lifestyles that so characterize many of us in modern cities are really the heart of the problem here. That is the motor of environmental pollution. And although things like recycling can mitigate the worst effects, it's this radical change of lifestyle that really needs to take place. And I believe that Christians can and should and are attempting to give a lead in that regard in inner cities. Finally, the principle of locality. Now, this principle is somewhat less clearly articulated in Christian social thought, it seems to me. If you ask me to identify, you know, even two or three serious books on this theme in the last 20 years, I'd struggle. Actually, they're probably on the back table there, if I can think of them. It's less clearly articulated, but it does seem to me that if we dig under the surface of what Christians have been saying, Christian social thinkers have been saying, there is a clear recognition of the importance of place for human beings. And I put it this way. Human beings are finite creatures. We have to live in particular places. We have to put down roots, build communities. And we can't be fully human if we are rootless cosmopolitans, jetting around the world or jetting around our own cities with no roots, no community, no sense of belonging. And what this surely means is developing attachments to particular localities, whether villages or towns or, in cities, neighborhoods. And so I'd suggest that one of the principal tasks that we face, Christians as well, in cities, is the recovery of, or the construction of, where they don't exist, vital, thriving neighborhoods. Neighborhoods where people actually know each other. Neighborhoods where it's safe to walk the streets. Where kids can tumble out in good weather and not be afraid of cars and other sorts of dangers. We need to go, in other words, beyond neighborhood watch schemes, which are basically defensive, to neighborhood building. And as I said earlier, I know how challenging that can be. In my own area of Toronto, the Bloor Lansdowne area, we lived, as I said, just half a block away from a concentration of really one of the worst spots of the city in terms of street life. A lot of dealing and prostitution and some violence as well. And just before we left Toronto, actually, an amazing guy attempted to kickstart some community spirit in that area of town. And he set up a little association, little website, you know, minimal resources. How it goes, you know, the handful of people with a vision, they start things and just begins to snowball. And one of the things he did, he managed to persuade businesses on our stretch of Bloor Street, just two, three blocks, there's maybe, you know, 15 businesses, part of a mini little trade association there, managed to persuade them to shell out, I don't know, $10,000, $15,000 to put some enormous flower pots right in the darkest part of the street, I mean, where all the activity was going on. Just as a signal to those who would sustain those kinds of unsavory activities, that there are people here, there are human beings here who care about the quality of life in this little stretch of a big city. And it was an incredible struggle. You know, the flowers wouldn't be watered, so they died. Trash was thrown into them. They were knocked over. Sometimes the flowers were just stolen right out of the pots. You know, you just go back the next day and there's nothing there. So it's an incredibly difficult challenge. And unfortunately, we weren't able to stay to help it along. But that's the kind of small gesture that I think is needed. And you can, of course, speak of many others in your own situations. Again, churches and faith communities can play a crucial role here. Let me emphasize this, because they tend to be long-standing stakeholders in neighborhoods. They stay put very often when everybody else leaves. And so I think it's good for churches to encourage people to stay in city neighborhoods and not move out en masse to the suburbs, to encourage their members to get involved in local activities for their own sake, as a contribution to the community, and not simply as a means to evangelize. I think my time is up. So what I've tried to do there is to spell out five key goals or principles that I've gleaned from various strands of Christian social thought that I think can begin to at least frame or stimulate some of our thinking about the cities. It's been at a fairly high level of abstraction. That's what I've been paid to do in my life. And I now look forward to getting the response from people like you who know what this means, if anything, on the ground. Thank you very much indeed.